morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here. Joining me in the studio today is
Mike Cosentino and
Gary LeMaster.
And we're talking on the phone with Michael Austin, who's the provost and vice president of academic affairs at Newman University in Wichita, Kansas. And we've had him on the show twice before talking about the Constitution. He's written a really interesting book that we keep reading and rereading. That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing. And I went on Amazon, and I guess because I bought Michael's books before, the Amazon recommended I buy one of his books called Rereading Job, Understanding the Ancient World's Greatest Poem. So Michael Austin spent most of his time writing about a 17th or 18th century writers and poets and religious interpretations of stuff. I really like the Job book. I told Michael it's the first time I ever probably bought a book from a Mormon religious publishing company. But it's really quite a good book, folks. And all the skills that Michael brings to understanding the Constitution, he brings to understanding these ancient scriptures. And he does show, and I think one of the nice things, at least for me, not knowing much about the LDS religion, is that it shows us there's not just one version, but there's lots of disagreement and discussion in that faith, like a lot of others. Michael, are you there?
Michael, are you there?
Hello, I'm here. Yes.
All
I hear
right.
you.
Hey, we gave you the introduction while you were off.
Yeah. You hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can now.
Well, trust us, it was a beautiful introduction.
Yeah, it was a beautiful introduction, Michael.
Don't want to ruin it.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I was complimenting you on your book on Job, which is not something I would normally read. But I've had a whole series of back problems and operations and stuff. I realized that psychologically a book on Job seemed really appropriate at the time.
And Steve had a lot of time to read.
Yes, I've had a lot of time to read these days.
Well, yeah, I don't think you were being singled out for punishment, but who knows? Maybe there is a Job. So we do have kind of a broad spectrum of things we're talking about this morning. And just because, maybe a college professor like Michael Austin here could make a connection between the Job effort and the Constitution interpretation. But you know, one is a religious poem and the other is a political poem, I guess, if you want to stretch our imagination a little bit.
I think the one thing that Michael talks about is proof texting. Why don't you tell us about proof texting? Because that's used in both interpreting religious text so that they agree to whatever you want them to say, and the other is that's been done with the Constitution now by a whole series of right-wing commentators and radio personalities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you want to look for a strong connection between the two books, it is that the Old Testament and the writings of the Founding Fathers are two sets of documents that are extremely susceptible to proof texting. That there's a whole lot there. People don't usually read most of the context. They pick out sentences and paragraphs here and there that support what they already believe, and then they advance that as what the text means. In both books, I'm trying to get behind the proof texting and provide the context and show that it's a lot more complicated than our proof texting makes it look like.
Yeah, and then when the next step, they claim, of course, authority from these sources.
Yes.
for their cause. In other words, the Book of Job, by virtue of being in the Bible, okay, now we can claim whatever, and the Constitution, by its status in American life, holds all kinds of, the sky opens up, angels begin to sing as soon as you say the word Constitution.
And that's, you know, that's the perennial problem with arguing about anything, is that you can really only have a productive argument if the people arguing have something beneath the disagreement that they agree on. And it's a basis for legitimating your arguments. You know, we have to agree on enough that we can appeal to something similar, or we can't even have a reasonable debate. And both the Bible and the works of the Founding Fathers have provided that legitimation in our culture for the debate. You know, both sides of the debate often agree, at least theoretically, in the value of those two sets of texts. So they are very powerful, what we call rhetorical legitimators.
Yeah, what is proof texting? Again, let's explain it to the audience. Because we did two other programs with Michael where he goes into some detail about what proof texting is. But let's explain it a little bit further before we go on.
Proof texting, if scholarship is drawing conclusions from your research, proof texting is drawing research from your conclusions. Proof texting is when you approach a large body of texts, and instead of looking at them independently in the context that they were originally created, you pull out words and sentences here and there and string them together in order to support the argument you want to make, with no sensitivity whatsoever to the original context.
And two of your examples, of course, are Glenn Beck and Mark
Levin.
We always mispronounce his name. But
I got called on that once. I called him Mark Levin on a C-SPAN interview, and several of his fans wrote in and told me that I was mispronouncing his name, and how could they take me seriously about anything?
Since you didn't know how to pronounce his name. I was about to mispronounce his name again.
Because everyone should know how to pronounce Mark Levin's name.
So what they're doing is they're looking at the Constitution and the writings around the Constitution, like the Federalist Papers, and they're selecting all the parts out of it that prove whatever it is they want to believe now. In other words, they read the Constitution and they find perfect support
perfect
for their point of view, for like a Tea Party point of view. But we asked you one time, it was kind of a disrespectful question in a way. We said, what did the founders agree on? Well, what did the founders actually agree on?
Yeah, they agreed, and I think 100% of the people we call founding fathers agreed that America should not be part of the British Empire.
Right.
But they didn't agree about much.
That's the only area of agreement I've ever found.
Yeah. And they didn't agree with themselves over time, did they?
No, absolutely not. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams ran one of the most contentious campaigns in American history in 1800. Just assailed each other. You know, Jefferson and his supporters said that John Adams was a pseudo-crypto-monarchist who was trying to establish a kingdom in America and name his son his prince. And Adams and his supporters said that Jefferson wanted to import guillotines to the banks of the Potomac and start cutting the heads off of anybody who had money.
Wow.
So rough political discourse begins when our country begins.
Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. Much more contentious than any election I've ever seen in my lifetime.
Well, you know, the name of your, what I found is out as a sermon, but I use as an essay, Our Bickering, I'm going to read a title of one of your essays, Our Bickering Founding Fathers and Their Messy, Imperfect, Inspired Constitution. And, excuse me, I do use it in my college class.
That was an essay that I originally wrote as a sermon for the Wichita Unitarian Church, and then published in Dialogue, which is an unofficial Mormon magazine. So that's a Unitarian Mormon sermon.
I see. Oh, wow, those good old Unitarians.
That is some real
pedigree.
Real reach there.
We see the Unitarians as being liberal Christians, and the Mormons as being not.
Yeah,
we'll just leave it at that.
Most religious traditions have much more diversity than their media profiles suggest.
Yeah, I remember talking to one of my colleagues one time, and I did tours, and I did this sort of spiritual tour, which we do in Sedona, and I took out two Mormon brothers, I think it was, and they were very interested in the spiritual things and vortexes and all the kind of Native American stuff. And I went back to my friend, and I said, you know, I took these two guys out, and you know, he's a Mormon, and I said, they're really sort of spiritually oriented people. And he said they were interested in blah blah. And he said they weren't Mormons. And I gave one of the dumbest answers of my life, and I said, well, they were from Utah. they weren't Mormon. But they knew an awful lot about the Mormon church and Mormon religion to not be Mormon. And why would they tell me they were Mormons when they weren't? But, yeah, I think the diversity of opinion, is really, an interesting thing that we don't see from the outside about other confessions.
Well, all churches, this is not the topic of the show, but coming to faith, through reason is certainly a big, there's a guy named Dante that felt like that was a big topic. And certainly the Catholics picked that up, and another, certainly the media profile, as Michael Austin says, is conservative, but within the Catholic Church, there's a raging argument all the time about how much reason you can apply to faithful principles, and that's actually, I think, at the core of all arguments on really how much reason can you apply to the Book of Job. I mean, you know, it was written.
Well, what we have to realize is that reason, and the way that we're cognitively set up, reason is something that we apply after we accept fundamental principles. In other words, we don't ever reason our way to fundamental principles about what we believe and value. Once we get there, then we're set up to use reason to build from those fundamental principles.
You said one time that that anytime somebody says the founding fathers thought X, that statement's always false.
Unless they're talking about whether or not America should be part of the British Empire.
Right.
One exception to that. Other than that, you know, about half of the people we call founding fathers were violently opposed to the Constitution. They were anti-federalists. People like John Hancock, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, opposed the Constitution, thought it was a document of monarchy, thought it would lead to America being re-enslaved with kings. The Constitution was absolutely not an article of agreement among the founding fathers.
So September 17th, 1787, only 39 of the 55 delegates signed onto the Constitution. I guess the Constitution originally was 4,000 words with amendments at about 8,000 words. I think when you go back and actually read the Constitution, a lot of it's really practical stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not soaring rhetoric like the Declaration of Independence, except for the prologue.
Right. The Constitution, it was originally created to renegotiate the relationships between the states and the federal government. And the founding fathers and the people in the founding generation who opposed the Constitution really wanted individual states in a very loose federation, something like the European Union would be today. And they saw the primary locus of power being the states. The Constitution specifically, it's a verb. Constitution is a verb. It constituted a country. It created a country, a federal government that that shared power between the federal government and the states. And it set up the rules of the game. I mean, it set up the playing field. The Constitution does not tell us what kind of country we should be. It tells us how to use a process to make ourselves the kind of country we want to be. I think that's a distinction that a lot of people miss. A lot of people want to go back to the Constitution and say, should we have higher taxes, should we have lower taxes? Well, the Constitution gives us the ability to decide for ourselves, should we have higher taxes or lower taxes. It doesn't tell us what the right answer is.
So it's not a sacred book in the sense that you can go and get a text that says, you know, thou shalt not kill. Even that gets open to an interpretation. But it's something that sets up a structure for dialogue, debate.
Well, I want
even unfriendly debate, right?
Exactly. I want to pick on the right wing, if I got, but first I want to read another title of one of Michael Austin's, in this case, I guess it was a lecture. Just his titles are certainly clear enough to state the position. This one is Manufacturing Intent. Manufacturing Intent, Five Ways to Abuse History While Pretending to Interpret the Constitution.
Yeah, that was a Constitution Day lecture I gave at the Robert Byrd Center in Jefferstown, West Virginia. And just talked about exactly this, that people very often want to go to the Constitution and figure out what the Founding Fathers were thinking.
Yep.
And to do that, they have to proof text. They have to look at things that, you know, a lot of people, I love reading people who will say, this is what Thomas Jefferson wrote in his journal. This is what John Adams wrote in a letter. We need to use these to interpret the Constitution, ignoring the fact that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams weren't even in the Western Hemisphere when the Constitution was written.
One of the other phenomena that kind of goes along with this, I just encountered in the past week in talking with someone who should know better, that when we were talking about actually your book and the founders' position on religion, they brought in some things that weren't even part of the Constitution. You know, they tend to back up their argument by saying, claiming that something was part of the Constitution that was never there. And specifically, they were talking about, well, if the founders didn't want this to be a Christian country, then why did they put "In God We Trust" on our money? And
yeah.
And
yeah,
why
you
did
know
they,
that didn't happen until the 1950s, I think. I actually have a dollar bill that doesn't have "In God We Trust" on it.
Right.
The founders didn't even create money.
The preamble of the Constitution have no mention of divinity. It's that it based on the people. It says, "We the people of the United States, right, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, and ensure domestic tranquility," and so forth and so on. But it's "we the people are establishing this constitution, do ordain and establish the Constitution for the United States of America." It doesn't really refer to deities one way or the other.
No, the only reference in the Constitution before the amendments, the only reference to religion in any way is in Article 6, where it says there will be no religious test for office. That's the only mention of religion in the Constitution. Then in the First Amendment, you get the two clauses that have become the major judicial approaches to the Constitution, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause.
Right.
So no establishment of religion, nothing to impede the free exercise of religion.
Why is going back and trying to figure out what the founders intended? Why is that such a bad idea? Why can't we really do that?
Because, first of all, we can't do it because the document was created by 55 people. And if you go back and look at their intentions, well, they didn't all have the same intentions. It's a compromise document. Compromise doesn't reflect anybody's original starting point or original intention. And secondly, we're not governed by their intentions. We're governed by what they wrote. We aren't governed by what they were thinking. We aren't governed by what they were writing to their friends. We aren't governed by what they said 30 years later in a political speech. We're governed by the words on the page. And we're responsible for taking those words. And the words on the page don't tell us what to do. They tell us how to do it.
So they don't say you should have high taxes or low taxes. They don't say you should avoid foreign wars or not. The Constitution really doesn't say it. I think when I was reading your book, one of the things I thought was interesting, you said part of the Constitution is really not open to interpretation. A lot of it's fairly mundane, straightforward stuff. It says each state shall have two senators. Well, there's not much to interpret there, right?
Right. There's no way you can get three out of that.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. If you watch Fox News, I think Sean Hannity could get three out of
it. Until you amend it. And if you want to amend it, you can amend it.
Go ahead.
There's a whole whole lot of language in the Constitution that was intentionally left interpretable. Make all laws necessary and proper. Well, what's necessary and proper? That's a judgment call. Necessary and expedient. All needful rules and regulations. Unreasonable searches and seizures. What's an unreasonable search and seizure? That's it, inherently a judgment call. So, I think even Justice Scalia agrees with this. He says that it would be a really silly way to interpret the cruel and unusual punishment clause to go back and look at what was cruel and unusual in the 18th century. That would include keel hauling and flogging were not considered cruel and unusual. But we consider those cruel and unusual today, and unusual especially is inherently a judgment call. It asks us to consider the context in which it is situated.
So the Constitution empowers the American people to make their own laws and decisions within a certain framework. It gives a blueprint of how the process of establishing a government and laws.
Right. It says how you pass some laws. Here's how you turn the intentions of 300 million people into laws that you can actually enforce.
There's a small movement to have another constitutional convention. You know, I hear that from the right, more often now. And I know Jefferson, I think was in your book, talked about that the Constitution was a good start and that he viewed it as something that could be revisited every generation, I think it was.
19 years, did he say?
Every 19 years. Yeah, I think, the call for another constitutional convention is one of the dumbest things I've heard recently. let me explain why I mean that.
Thank you.
Changing the Constitution in fundamental ways is something that is possible when there is great agreement that it needs to be changed. In other words, the thresholds for changing the Constitution are very, very high. They were meant to be more than reflective of partisan divisions. They were meant to reflect a genuine consensus in the country that things need to change. We are at a very divided partisan political point right now. We don't have that consensus. So to try to use constitutional changes in order to drive a very partisan agenda is just dumb, because that's not how the Constitution was built. It was the way that it can be changed is when there's general agreement, not when there's just almost pathological disagreement.
Good point.
The other thing I got from your book, or was reminded from the book, is there's no single hero among the founders. I mean, I always loved Jefferson, free thinker, he's a vast and multi-talented person. But in a lot of his stuff was really, really, I mean, the idea of changing the Constitution every 19 years is really a bad idea. And then he had an idea that what each branch of the government could decide what was constitutional according to their, it's a really bad idea. And I guess when I read your book and I read in the Federalist Papers again, I was reminded that Hamilton seemed to have a better sense of where the country is going. Do you think because he was involved in economics, Jefferson seemed to think that the country would be this agrarian thing. A lot of hypocrisy. He has all the slaves supporting him, but he sort of very impressed with the yeoman farmers and stuff. But Hamilton seems to have a better sense of the economics of the future and the kind of institutions needed as the country moved forward.
Hamilton, in my opinion, Hamilton was the real driver of the Federalist period. Jefferson was brilliant. He believed two things on almost everything. I mean, Jefferson was just a huge bundle of contradictions. He was very idealistic. He was a slave owner. He believed in a very constrained government until he needed to purchase Louisiana, in which case he expanded the size of the country with no constitutional mandate. Jefferson was a very contradictory, inconsistent figure. Hamilton was not born in the colonies. Hamilton was not born on the mainland. He was from the island of Nevis in the Caribbean. So Hamilton never belonged to a state. He always saw the United States as a country. And that was something that most of the founders did not see. They grew up, Jefferson grew up a Virginian. Adams grew up a Massachusettsian.
Yeah.
You call that.
One I have is what are Connecticut's people called?
Franklin was a Pennsylvanian. So they grew up seeing themselves as part of a state, and then they saw that they needed to try to knit their states into a greater federation. But Hamilton never had a state. Hamilton came, he was a foreigner, he was an immigrant. So Hamilton came, and he never saw anything but the United States as one great country. And that is the vision that he had from the time he came when he was 15 and started writing pamphlets against the British up until his service in Washington's cabinet. He was always considering the United States as a country, not a loose federation of independent, autonomous powers.
Well, and Virginia had such... I mean, in our founding documents, you know, Virginia has major documents with that, the Virginia Charter, the Virginia Resolution. I mean, all of these pre-Constitution things, which I don't know the scholarship, but that these things led up to the Constitution. And I want to remind, because a lot of us don't, you know, think about it all the time, we're talking about the U.S. Constitution, a preamble, seven articles, something we call the Bill of Rights.
27 amendments, I think it is.
And Amendment 11 through 27. That's it. That's the document, boys and girls. Now, what I want to get to desperately is how Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck abuse this document.
Well, they start with what they want to prove. I mean, and most of us do. We all do that. It's not just Hannity and Beck. But... one of the things, you know, the first book I ever wrote was called Useful Fictions. It was a look at the cognitive apparatus that gives us fiction.
Right.
And what the most disturbing thing I discovered in that book, and the things that conditioned almost everything I've done since then, is that human reason did not evolve to get to the truth. Human reason evolved to win arguments. You know, it's.
I hate to hear that, but I do take it in.
Our reasoning capacity is like the antlers of an elk. You know, we evolved to win interspecies arguments, to protect territory, to get mates. I mean, it did not evolve to produce truth. So when we reason, and we have a very powerful reasoning capability that is not oriented towards finding true things. We start with what we want to believe, and then we look for ways to prove it. And that's exactly how most people, and especially Glenn Beck and Mark Levin, or however he says his name, and Sean Hannity, that's how they look at the Constitution. They know what they believe. They believe that we should be a small government confederation of states where people get to keep all of their money and do whatever they want except occasionally serve in the military. And that's their position. And then they go out looking for what in the Constitution and what in the Founding Fathers supports that idea. And they will always find it because there's tons of text to choose from. So then they construct this idea that this is what the Founding Fathers believed and this is what we should believe. And it's a misunderstanding both of how the Constitution works and of what the Founding Fathers said. But again, the reasoning capacity is there to support what we already think.
Well, and as you said earlier, if they can't find it in the Constitution, then they'll find it in a letter, right, you know, that one of the Founding Fathers wrote, or a note, or something else that isn't the part of the governing document.
And liberals do it, too.
Yeah.
Liberals aren't immune from this kind of reasoning.
That's true.
The last time I mentioned the Treaty of Tripoli, where the United States goes into a treaty with the, what do you call the Barbary Pirates, and it says the United States was in no sense based on a religion or is not a Christian nation and stuff.
Yeah,
as we talked about before, that's the language of diplomacy. You're dealing right. with some Muslims, and you want to tell them this is not a religious fight. We just don't want you, you know, seizing our ships. And that's, you know, that's selective too.
Right. The United States, no country creates its core identity through treaties with pirates.
Yeah. Rereading, no, that's not what they meant, reclaiming the founding fathers from America's right wing. You have some devastating portraits of how people like Glenn Beck and Mark Levine have proof text, how they've assembled these quotations from a whole bunch of different things, how they're not even close. I've never seen such a disrespect. I mean, they'll take one of Hamilton's the Federalist Papers and just entirely dishonestly, it seems to me intellectually dishonestly, rewrite it so it says whatever they want. I mean, the extreme way that they've done things is a surprise. And if you don't think so, folks, you can read Michael's book, because he's, you know, he's very, 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 he takes a scholar and critics tools to taking extreme positions on the Constitution based on not really caring much what it actually says, I think.
And, right. And, they're trying to use it to prove something.
And we've forgotten to mention one of Michael's other books that I think is the least expensive book I've ever seen on Amazon.
It now says 0 to 99 cents.
which is, that's not what they meant about guns. And I found that extremely useful as well. Maybe you could address that just briefly.
Well, let me tell you the story about that's not what they meant about guns. I didn't deal with gun control when I was writing the book because it wasn't really an issue that was being talked about a lot at the time, and I was on a pretty tight deadline. We were trying to get the book out before the 2012 election, so I didn't do a chapter on gun control. And a few months after the book came out, the shootings in Connecticut happened, the school shootings. And all of a sudden, gun control became just the central issue of our political discourse. So I wrote to my publishers and I said, you know, would you mind? I feel really bad. I did not include a chapter on gun control, and now it's really hot. And boy, I wish I'd written that chapter and taken another couple of months with it. Would you mind if I wrote a little one-chapter sequel called That's Not What They Meant About Guns and just put it up myself on Amazon and sold it for 99 cents as a way to promote the book? And I periodically make it free and give it away with links to the book. So can I use this title, That's Not What They Meant, and put About Guns on it? And they said, sure, that sounds like a good idea. So That's Not What They Meant About Guns is just, it's the one chapter that didn't get into That's Not What They Meant that I regretted not putting in. So it's my afterthought.
Well, that's then and topical it is. So what didn't they mean about guns, Michael?
Well, the Second Amendment, like everything else in the Constitution, was a process of negotiation among people who believed and wanted different things. It was not primarily designed to protect individual gun ownership, because individual gun ownership was not controversial at the time. Everybody owned guns. There was no reason not to own guns. So it was not, there was nothing like gun control that we understand that needed the protection of the Second Amendment. If you look at all of the different state versions of the Second Amendment, 9 of the 13 original colonies have statements that the right to bear arms should not be infringed, and either as part of the same article or the immediate article after that, it says that there will never be a standing army. The state will never have a standing army. We will only use the militia. And that was originally how the Second Amendment was conceived of. It would say, in effect, there will always be a militia. We will always protect the right of the people to bear arms, which really meant to serve in the militia, and we will never establish a standing army.
Because the British came in and disbanded American militias, right?
Right.
That's what the context.
Right. And then the next amendment is about quartering soldiers, which goes with there not being a standing army. Well, George Washington and Alexander Hamilton didn't like militia troops. They served with them in the Revolution. They thought that they were untrained, that they were unruly, they were ungovernable. So they lobbied very hard against a constitutional provision against standing armies. They wanted standing armies. They did not want to rely on militias for the defense of the United States. So what the Second Amendment is an amendment that guarantees protection of the militia and eliminate standing armies, with the eliminating standing armies part cut out and just half of it there. So it's a very confusing sentence, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free people, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It leaves out the part that the defense of the United States will always be entrusted to the militia, because Washington and Hamilton did not want that in there.
I see.
And some of the versions had an exception for Quakers, and that was taken out, too. For
Madison originally wanted an exception for Quakers, and that really was the constitutional issue at the time wasn't should people be allowed to own guns, because, again, that was not a controversial point at the time. It was, can everybody be required to serve in the militia? And Madison wanted an exception for Quakers. Again, Hamilton and Washington did not. They said this is a duty. We should not give a religious exemption to a duty to serve.
Well, that's a slippery slope, too. Even in 1789, I imagine that you start giving exemption for one religion, where would you stop?
And I don't think most people know the Constitution often says in the American law, swear or affirm, and Quakers didn't believe in swearing, so it gave them an alternative phrase, I guess, to use.
Right. Yeah, and you know, the use of the Second Amendment to protect individual gun ownership was not part of the Constitution until the Supreme Court's Heller versus D.C. decision in 2008. And even there, Justice Scalia gives you all kinds of ways that the state can legitimately control the sale and the possession and the use of firearms.
But certainly what we hear from the Tea Party is it's an absolute, unquestioned right. And that stuff about the militia is just irrelevant. And it can't be, guns can't be regulated, and they believe, well, let's take the Clive and Bundy. Did you read about the standoff in Utah?
Yes, I did read about Mr. Bundy.
Yes. Now, how would George Washington have treated that? I mean, he won't pay his fees to the government for our land that he's using, and he organizes an armed militia to refuse to pay.
Yeah, we don't even have to wonder how George Washington would have dealt with that, because that was the Whiskey Rebellion. And Washington called out the army and led it himself, is how he dealt with it.
And he went right over and
put it down.
I like that. I'd like to see Obama at that going in. I would love that. As a matter of fact, I'd be standing three steps behind him. Well, maybe several.
So
is it
technically or legally, the courts had ruled against him again and again. He refuses to recognize the court. He refused to recognize the federal government of the United States. He organizes armed resistance. They back off because the people who are with him want to have martyrs, and they're aware of that.
Yeah,
and that's happened on the left as well as the right. They want martyrs
of American government.
But is he guilty of sedition or treason? What is the possibilities here?
You know, I think treason is very specifically defined in the Constitution, and I don't know if he's guilty of treason. I think he's awfully close to the line. You know, the Constitution And this is probably, I think, the biggest mistake that the far right makes, is they have somehow constructed the Second Amendment as conveying a right to revolution, a right to treason or sedition, a right to the sort of a last resort against tyranny. And the Second Amendment has never had anything to do with a last resort against tyranny. It's exactly the opposite. It was designed to make sure that the militia was always available to put down rebellions. It was never designed to enable people to mount rebellions. Washington would have had no problem calling somebody like Cleveland Bundy a traitor. Jefferson probably would have secretly admired him a little bit. So the Founding Fathers wouldn't have agreed on that. But yeah, Washington, you know, what Cleveland Bundy did was very, very similar to what happened during the Whiskey Rebellion, and Washington had to be talked out of hanging the leaders of that rebellion.
Speaking of Bundy, and here in the Southwest, as well, the West, I guess, in general, there's a growing movement of sovereign citizens, and I was just curious how you would put that in context with the history of the United States, particularly going back to the Constitution. Was there, you know, that sort of a movement after the Constitution was ratified?
Yes. I mean, that's the anti-federalist position. People taking those kinds of positions are taking the same position that the people who didn't want the Constitution ratified took. The ultra-states right position, the sovereign citizens position, that was a position in the founding era. It's the position that Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton and Washington all spent their lives opposing. But yes, those people did exist. I think that that there are countries which have very, very minimal governments. Somalia, maybe. Rwanda. Exactly. I mean, there are places people can move if they want very little government interference in their lives. But we have a country, and there are rights and responsibilities that are part of being that country that the founders certainly recognized, and those aren't optional.
Exactly. I, once again, going back to some of the other founding documents, the Articles of Confederation, I mean, all those things that didn't work, at least what, you know, if you want to consider a collection of founding documents, we have all those things that didn't work until we found the one that did.
The Tea Party platform is very similar to the Articles of Confederation.
Exactly.
Which was rejected in 1787.
What they're after is the kind of country that the Founding Fathers rejected.
Well, that's interesting. So much for inspiration.
So just sort of sum up, the Constitution is a product of compromise.
Yes.
It's not a you say in your book, it's not a process of being agreeable, because they fought with each other until they signed it, or they decided not to sign it.
Right.
And it's a structure for people to understand how to do government and how to do a country. I want to thank you for being with us. Always enjoyed talk to you.
And I'd like to encourage everybody to buy the book. I found it to be invaluable, and I use it as a reference whenever I have one of these debates with others.
We don't have a lot of announcements. We want to thank Door and Dove, two local organizations, for contributing to the program. But we do have a letter.
We
Mike
have
wants
a fan letter, and we want to read this. Don't go away, Michael. We may need you. But we've been talking to Michael Austin, and author of "That's Not What They Meant," taking back the Constitution from the right wing. But one of the things I want to talk about is a lady that wrote to us from Austin, Texas, of all places. That she's been listening to Democratic Perspective for a couple of years through a kind of a mirror site, something called TuneIn Radio, and she lost it for a while, and she was struggling to find it. And she gave us encouragement on what she called our grassroots reasonable liberal point of view.
Why don't you give her a shout out there? We wouldn't have heard from her if she hadn't lost our broadcast when she couldn't get them on TuneIn.
So Catherine McGrath sent us this fan letter from her iPhone from Austin, Texas.
And at least wasn't denouncing us to various...
That's right. Thank you, Catherine. And thank you, Michael Austin. Kathleen, I'm sorry. And Michael Austin, we want to have you back. We love talking about this constitutional stuff. Are you okay with that?
Absolutely. Just give me a few days' notice.
Okay, all right.
We do try to do that. Yeah. I mean, okay. We're Democrats, but we do try to give you a couple of days. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Join us next week, folks. Exciting new program. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.